This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Good day, friends. Time for Community or Chaos. And we have with us Professor Benjamin McKen. And he's here for the DeKalb Lectures at the Otago University, a series of six lectures. And he's done work concerning global justice, climate change, populism, and the relationship between theory and practice. And his research in the inadequacy of the existing political concepts for addressing climate change. Could you tell us a bit about the title of your present series of six lectures, and very briefly, what they're about?
So the lecture series that I just finished delivering at the university was called Climate Change Politics from Despair to Solidarity, which is a movement that I hope many of us can undertake as we think about this difficult issue. So I began by addressing this question of whether or not despair is an obstacle to climate change, because there seem to be so many good reasons to be despairing about the prospect of making a difference on this issue and actually addressing this crisis. And so I think what I do in that first lecture was I looked at a number of ways that people tried to promote hope as an antidote to despair. And I suggested that they were really more like wishful thinking, and that in fact, we needed to think about ways of taking action while not trying to abandon our despair. So in the second lecture, I looked at a similar issue about the notion of progress, because it seems like climate change really challenges our notion of progress. We want to think that things are just getting better over time, but with respect to climate, they're getting worse. So what does that mean for us? What does that mean for the way we think about our lives together and the future of humanity? And then in the third and fourth lectures, I began thinking through questions about, well, who's going to do this, right? I don't mean like naming the individuals, because we're all going to have to take part in it, but who is the sort of collective agent of social transformation? How can we imagine transforming the global economy? I mean, who's going to take on a job of that size? What will it mean for the people to do it? How are the people going to be organized? How are we going to challenge not just elites, but a whole global economic structure? And in the fourth lecture, I looked at ways of thinking about how we can be organized together that don't marginalize Indigenous politics, but at least have the potential to center Indigenous politics. In the fifth lecture, I looked at people's hopes that the market could solve this problem, that perhaps we don't need collective political action. We can just expect capitalism to take care of it for us as renewable energy gets cheaper and cheaper. And I raised some reasons, some arguments to doubt that will take care of the problem for us. And in the last lecture on solidarity, I looked at some ways we could organize ourselves together in order to address this problem. How can we actually be in organizations that will make us feel like we are in solidarity with each other? So that's sort of a quick overview of some of the lecture topics.
So the problem is that we need drastic cultural and economic change, and those changes usually take a long time, but we don't seem to have the time.
That's right. One of the difficulties that we face is there's obviously an enormous amount of urgency around climate. Every year that we fail to bring emissions down is another year where things are getting worse and we're getting closer to potentially catastrophic tipping points. At the same time, the tools of politics that we have do take time. In order to move people to take radical political action, in order to move people to engage in the kinds of social and cultural changes that are required to address this issue, you have to build relationships. You have to build relationships of trust. People need to be asked to do difficult things by people they know. Right now, we live in a political culture where information can spread very rapidly, but so can disinformation. People can share memes. People can even turn up to protests, but that doesn't seem like it's enough. And so I think that part of what we need is time to develop these relationships where people can learn from each other, learn to trust each other, and be reminded what sort of community is in a way where they might be willing to sacrifice for each other, meaningfully identify with each other. And that requires a fight for time, right? That requires giving ourselves the time we need to do this, which isn't going to be easy because it's not only climate change that's depriving us of time and making us feel urgent, but, you know, we all have jobs. We all live in a capitalist economy where time is scarce, where there's a kind of artificial scarcity of things. And so I think that that's part of why the fight against climate change needs to be a fight for time, a fight against those kinds of time pressures on us so that we can make the time that we need to be with each other, develop the kinds of relationships we need to build the kind of politics it will take to take on this issue.
Okay. Well, you just brought me back to, I didn't play a promo, so I'm going to play it now.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Well, speaking of time, it seems to me that people have a number of ways they look at climate change. First, you have people that deny it sometimes out of despair, but also the people that really push denial are the ones that gain from not dealing with climate change, not stopping producing more and more oil and using coal. But then you've got people who do deny it, and then you've got people who recognize climate change, but technology and progress will solve it. And then you've got people that work on it as best they can and accept that it's a real essential problem for life on Earth.
I think that's a very helpful way of dividing things up. I think a lot of people want to take the issue of climate change seriously, but the structure of the world we live in makes it hard. I think it's very easy to discredit people who are trying to take action around climate change because even their own lifestyles unavoidably are going to be very carbon intensive for many people, given the infrastructure of the world that we have. So, you know, you get everything from sort of bad faith right-wing attacks on people like Al Gore or Greta Thunberg for flying because that's carbon intensive, to, as you suggested, outright denial. And the world we live in makes it very hard to live our values, right? To live in a way that's consistent with sustainability is almost impossible for lots and lots of people. And so one of the results of that is a lot of ordinary people who could be persuaded to take climate change seriously sort of feel like there must be a solution that's in the offing because they don't see political leaders taking it seriously. I think for a lot of people, it's easy to live in a world where you just assume someone else is taking care of the problem. And as you suggested, the people who are in charge, political and economic elites, do obviously, by definition of their role, benefit from the status quo. They're very reluctant to upset the apple cart. So we're in a very bad situation where people who want to take climate change seriously, it's very difficult for them to live their lives in a way that's consistent with that, to show to other people that it's possible. Ordinary people who could be persuaded to take it seriously look around and they don't see a world where anyone's taking the kind of radical action that's required. And so they sort of assume radical action isn't required. One of the results of that is empowering outright climate deniers on the authoritarian right, because they can say things like, you know, the world we live in doesn't seem to be taking it seriously, so it's a hoax. And, you know, there's that sense in which they're right, because if you look around, the leadership of the world isn't taking it seriously. And so it's easy for the right to say that they're lying, because in a sense, those leaders are lying. They say they're taking it seriously and they're not. But that doesn't mean that it's not a real problem. It's a deeply real problem. But the failure to take it seriously opens up a political space for these actors.
Isn't it actually more serious than, say, I'm not negating this, the invasion of Iraq. I mean, the invasion of Ukraine by Putin. I mean, it seems to me that one of the tragedies of Ukraine wasn't just that Ukraine's been unjustifiably invaded by their larger neighbor, but it's also taken European minds off climate change to a certain degree. And even to build up a military means carbon, huge carbon.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right that any kind of military activity is going to be very carbon intensive. And I think you're also right that there's a sense in which Putin's invasion of Ukraine was a moment of opportunity for Europe to take climate more seriously, because with the threat that it poses to natural gas pipelines, it's another reason, it's one of many good reasons to pivot to renewable energy. And there was a surge of investment in renewables, but we can already see that it's slacking in Europe. And so it has not proven a spur to address this issue at all. As you suggested, it's just become another crisis that has to be dealt with, distracting people's attention from this very big crisis that literally everybody on the planet needs to be concerned with.
I think many of us, perhaps most of us who are aware of climate change in the West, think that somehow progress will save us, and that we'll either science will find answers or we'll geoengineer. Now, I have two problems with that. One, it stops us from doing what's necessary to mitigate climate change. The other thing is that many of the things you could do in geoengineering, you can do, and they might work as long as you're doing them. But once you stop doing them, you get immediate, fast climate warming, because the thing that's been holding it up artificially is gone. So that means you have to have a civilization and technology that can do this forever.
Right. No, I think that you're identifying two really important problems. One is, of course, people want a quick fix or a silver bullet for this problem, because fixing it is expensive. It requires a radical change in the way we've structured the entire global economy.
It's culturally and historically expensive, as well as money.
Right. Well, that's the other problem, which is, as you said, we've lived under expectations of progress for a long time, and they're very hard to shake people out of. Obviously, it hasn't always been the case that humans lived in a world in which we expected progress. Most of human history is not necessarily a story where people expected progress. But certainly over the past several centuries, that's been the expectation. And I think for many people, you know, the catastrophes of the 20th century shook their faith in that. World wars, the Holocaust, other genocides, for many people provided a reason to doubt progress. But even those catastrophes haven't really shaken this widespread expectation of progress and basically unlimited growth. And I do think you're right. We need to challenge some of those expectations, or rather, we need to take seriously this problem that we face and recognize that dealing with climate does challenge these expectations of progress kind of happening automatically.
Life really challenges. I was in the library because I came in early by bus, and I saw this book called Those Who Are Gone Are Here. And it's really about Latin and South America, particularly Central America, how the reason for the huge immigration, not from Mexico so much, but from Central America, is because America, with their economic and foreign policy and their interventions in the 70s, 80s, and later,
in
now,
the 50s, even, I mean, going back to the coup in Guatemala,
they made life hell, life impossible in Central America. So they had to go somewhere. It's like what happens to the Palestinians in Gaza when they're no longer allowed to live in Gaza.
And of course, the migrant
issue. It made
issue.
Me feel really sick inside, because I can remember when it was happening. It was still when I was living in America. And some things you really don't want to remember. You don't want to know.
Well, and a lot of these refugee issues are also climate issues as well. So you're already seeing climate change affecting Central America in a way that's causing many farmers to be unable to sustain their existence there and contributing to the flight north to the United States. And we'll see a lot more of that as climate change proceeds. I think one of the big worries is we're going to need to resettle a lot of people. And if we let the reactionary right be in charge, we're going to see a hardening of borders, a refusal of these populations, very likely effectively more genocidal effects as people try and prevent climate refugees from entering these other countries. So I think there's some potentially very bad futures that are out there that are like what you've described, but much more intense.
To some extent, the refusal to deal with climate change and the cause of climate change is related to capitalism, isn't it? To particular form of capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, without restraints. Is Elon Musk and billionaires, are they the face of capitalism?
Well, I think you're right that we need to address capitalism as being one of the root causes of climate change. And to do that, we need to understand what capitalism is. As your mention of Elon Musk suggests, I mean, one of the things it is it's an engine for inequality. And so one of the effects that we have of the widening inequality in the neoliberal era is you now have billionaires like Musk in charge basically of the U.S. government and using it as a tool to further enrich themselves. Now, of course, to some extent, it's always been the case that the wealthy have been using the state to enrich themselves. But one of the things that Musk is doing that's really radical is he's also stripping a lot of the sort of core functions of the post-World War II welfare state out. Just very basic things like, you know, the government in the United States keeping track of weather data. All these kinds of things are being eliminated. And so I think among the problems we can identify with capitalism, among the ways we can say it's an obstacle to addressing climate change is certainly the way that it empowers billionaires to control our politics and to prevent people from democratically being involved in addressing issues like climate in the way they need to be addressed.
One of the things which feels almost like a contradiction. I mean, I don't think anybody would accuse Musk of being totally stupid. Maybe evil, but not. But they're trying to destroy science and people's attachment to science and people's opening to science. So we know what's happening scientifically to, for instance, with climate change.
I think the destruction of science is obviously very important from the perspective of addressing the climate crisis, but not, of course, only from that. I mean, they're attacking cancer research. There's all kinds of things that are going on, and I think it's a product of a few different things. One is the terminal sort of short-sightedness that's promoted by capitalism, right? I think for a lot of people, a lot of billionaires, it becomes hard to think past the financial quarter. And so they see these government expenditures as expenses and they don't see the benefits because the benefits do take longer than a financial quarter to accrue. They also, I think, really detest the idea of other forms of authority other than wealth. Part of the attack on science is an attack on the idea that knowing stuff has its own kind of authority. They really do want to reduce authority to whoever has the most money. Another part of it is, of course, the backlash against the government actions around COVID, which is ironic because Donald Trump was president during the initial stages of the COVID crisis in the U.S. But it's undoubtedly the case that people did not like the government's actions then, and they have used that as an opportunity to further attack scientific expertise, having any authority in the political realm. And as you suggested, they do also want to promote a kind of dependence on their knowledge, which is connected, I think, also with their kind of hyperbolic enthusiasm for, you know, so-called generative AI, which they think will just somehow be able to solve all these medical problems for them. So who needs scientists if you can just give it to their computer algorithm?
Aren't wealthy people, in some ways, many of them very isolated from the rest of the world, and they feel entitled, a strong entitlement, but also they don't need public schools. They don't need public hospitals. This is not only true in America, but to other countries, even in New Zealand to a certain extent. You're less likely to want to pay taxes for schools or hospitals if you know that you can do without them. You can either go to a private insurance and private hospitals, or you can even go overseas if you're really wealthy.
Undoubtedly, and I do think you're right, that libertarianism as a political philosophy is mostly appealing to people who are already quite wealthy. I do think that one of the reasons why billionaires or people like that can be empowered is because that individualizing happens to lots of people across the economic spectrum. So even people who are dependent on the social and political infrastructure that makes all kinds of activities possible, particularly, again, I'm coming from the United States context where some of these sorts of – this ethos of individualism is obviously particularly intense and longstanding. But there is a real appeal that those kinds of views have even to people further who aren't as rich. Otherwise, if everyone else could easily recognize the fact that that we're in this together, then billionaires would know they were outnumbered. But a lot of people, again, particularly in the US, consider themselves temporarily embarrassed millionaires. They don't think about themselves as being dependent or engaging in cooperative activity in those ways. And so part of addressing climate has to be overcoming those attitudes and helping people see that we are deeply reliant on each other.
Is this one reason for the extreme reaction against vaccination and against wearing masks and isolation during COVID, but particularly vaccination?
Absolutely.
Don't we get vaccinated for our neighbors, for our community, so we don't give it to someone else?
Exactly. That's why you see, I think, a lot of the same people who are climate deniers also engaging in various kinds of denial about COVID and about pandemics generally. I think you're exactly right. It's why someone like RFK Jr. makes sense as a part of Trump's political coalition. There are different ways of denying the ways that we're reliant on each other.
I think many of us recognize that global cooperation is necessary to deal with climate change. But must this take into account indigenous peoples and indigenous politics? The West does not actually make up the majority of the world, and it is unlikely to continue the homogenic power it once had. Could you talk about this briefly?
Yeah. A lot of the attitudes that I'm talking about are attitudes that are common in the developed world and settler colonial societies. And there are other attitudes that have cultures that have never embraced the visions of progress, for example, that I've been describing. And so I do think it's important as we think about these issues not to reinscribe these expectations that we're trying to fight. So one of the things that I think is particularly important as we think about what political leadership looks like is it's easy for us to think about, oh, well, leading on the climate crisis, it matters, you know, who's the president of the United States. It matters who's, holding elected office. But there are other forms of leadership and other ways of organizing society. And so I do think we want to be open to climate leadership looking quite different. Climate leadership doesn't need to be, you know, the developed world trying to tell the rest of the world what to do. That hasn't really worked out so well so far. So I do think it makes sense to look to indigenous groups in the United States and North America, the Native American groups that are leading the fight against new oil and natural gas pipelines, for example, are providing climate leadership that the whole world can look to. And I do think we have a deep-seated problem in a lot of climate and environmental movements that are very white-dominated spaces that are framing these issues and talking about these issues in a way that reflects their own experiences, but in doing that both keeps other groups out and fails to recognize the leadership that many other groups are already providing, doing a lot more than some of the self-proclaimed environmental groups themselves.
Wasn't this one of the achievements and reasons why Pope Francis was important?
I do think that that Pope Francis's encyclical on climate change was a very useful political tool for a lot of groups all over the world in Latin America and elsewhere to show that you don't need to, you know, be coming at this issue from a my own kind of like radical left perspective. There are very good reasons grounded in much more conservative cultural traditions and religious traditions to take climate very seriously. And I know that the new Pope Leo is also someone who has written and spoke about climate change, taken it quite seriously. And so I do think that there are ways of providing those kinds of religious models of stewardship of the earth that are very important. And again, I think that's something that lots of different religious and cultural traditions can provide. Obviously, by virtue of being hierarchically organized and global, the Catholic Church provides a sort of dramatic example of that. But there are also much more dispersed and decentralized religious traditions that also can provide really valuable models for taking this seriously that don't require embracing, as it were, the full catalog of my politics or anything like that.
There's evidence, although green energy has really soared with solar panels, wind farms, electric cars, and other non-carbon energy and technology, and continues to grow and become cheaper. But the use of energy grows faster than the use of non-carbon. That actually, as we've produced more non-carbon energy through wind farms and panels, we've also, the use of energy has increased so much that the warming effect of carbon, coal, but particularly oil, has continued to increase. And also it's turned out to be still the most popular way of making money. You can make a lot more money with oil than you can with solar panels or wind farms.
That's right. There has been, when people look for reasons to be hopeful about the climate crisis, they point to the declining cost of renewable energy. And of course, that's a very important component of any kind of solution. We're not going to give up as a species generating energy. And so we need to shift to more sustainable sources. But as you said, they still represent a relatively small proportion of global energy use, around 15% compared to the 85% of fossil fuel use, even as the solar and wind energy use are growing. They are still less profitable than most fossil fuel sources for companies. So it's been the case for the past 3 or 4 years that the most profitable company in the world is Saudi Aramco, the Saudi Arabian National Oil Company, more valuable, more profitable than Apple or NVIDIA or Google or any other kind of hot tech company. And renewables just can't compete with that on a profit basis, which is part of why we need to shift away from a profit basis as the reasoning for addressing this issue. I do think that the other part of the story, as you suggested, is global energy use is still growing. Some of that is because for, as it were, hopeful reasons that we have more countries lifting, like getting less poor. And so their own lifestyles are getting more energy intensive. But also, of course, a lot of the story is just that the developed world, the already rich, are living lives that remain very carbon intensive. So we do need very deep changes. On the one hand, we do want to address poverty. We don't want anybody in this world to live in poverty. But we need to find ways of addressing that that don't require as much fossil fuel use. And we, at the same time, need to get those who are already rich to dramatically cut their emissions. And so far, we still haven't, outside of the pandemic year of 2020, we have not lived in a society where global carbon emissions have declined. We've seen the rate of growth slow, but obviously that's not anywhere near what we need to do.
Thomas Piketty, the French economist, says the evidence shows us that capitalism depends on continued growth, inequality, and increasing wealth. The capitalism we know is incompatible with a healthy social and physical environment and tackling climate change successfully. I'm going to come back to that. I'm going to play some, take a break and then come back to that. We can think about that.
This is a chorus from a translation I did of a Greek play, Philoctetes, from the Cure at Troy. Human beings suffer. They torture one another. They get hurt and get hard. No poem or play or song can fully right a wrong inflicted and endured. The innocents in jails beat on their bars together. A hunger striker's father stands in the graveyard dumb. Police widow in veils faints in the funeral home. History says don't hope on this side of the grave, but then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up, and hope and history rhyme. So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a farther shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells. Call miracle self-healing, the unpredictable double-take of feeling. If there's fire on the mountain and lightning and a storm and a god speaks from the sky, that means someone is hearing the outcry and the birth cry of new life at its term. It means, once in a lifetime, that justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme.
That was a poem by Sean Seamus. I'm probably mispronouncing the Irish name. You want to respond to that poem, actually.
Well, I do like the idea of making hope and history rhyme, but I do think that one of the challenges that we face is, you know, in the past, we've tried to make sense of catastrophes and said, well, this makes sense. At least we've learned from it. There's some way of advancing. There's a way of making it consistent with progress. And I think that one of the challenges we face is the possibility that attitude of trying to subsume everything under that idea of progress, that determination to make hope and history rhyme, in some ways can be part of the problem. That in fact, what we need right now in a world that remains, as it were, kind of split, oscillating between absolute panic at climate and total complacency, is to find some other way of addressing this. To sort of say, maybe, you know, we don't need panic. Panic doesn't help anybody, but hope. Well, I mean, hope can also have a way of convincing people it'll be all right in the end. And right now, that's not assured.
I think one of the, well, this is personal, but one of the disappointments in my life was I was very aware of I saw pictures of Dachau being liberated when I was 5 or 6. I saw, there were photographs of a man who'd been there, who was Jewish. And I always believed that if we were responsible, that would never happen again. That one of the hopes of my life was that genocide would never happen again. And of course, I've been disappointed in that. So I have to look at, find that hope. Anyway, I think that we have to look at reality and accept reality, but also find hope. Hope to make us act.
Yeah. No, I think a lot about, so in my academic work as a scholar of political theory, I engage quite closely with the Frankfurt School tradition of critical theory. And the Frankfurt School were a group of mostly Jewish German Marxists who were trying to understand what happened in the 20th century, understand the rise of fascism, understand the Holocaust. And one of those thinkers, Theodor Adorno, famously said that it was impossible to write poetry after Auschwitz, that once you knew humanity was capable of that kind of atrocity, it was very hard to make meaning. It just, what could it mean that we are the kind of creatures that, that could do that to each other? And I do think that one of the things that we've seen, so there's a lot I could say about the interpretation that Adorno and the Frankfurt School of Critical Theorists offer to understand what they call the dialectic of enlightenment and the way that it produced the Holocaust. But I think part of what we need to take away from it is that we have moved in some ways very far away from that recognition of the horror of what humanity could do to each other. And I think some of the reasons for that are that a lot of those horrors have become kind of normalized. Many of the ways that we've continued to live in a society that in many different ways treats people as disposable. And so when we see that kind of mass atrocity that treats an entire population as disposable, in a lot of ways, the way has been prepared by the way we've had to learn to become indifferent to each other. We know so much about what happens on this planet of 8 billion people. There's so many horrors all the time that in order to go on living, as Adorno says, you kind of have to make yourself cold to these people in order to live your own life. And so part of the tragedy of that is that, of course, we can lean into that feeling of indifference. We can cultivate it. In some ways, doing that makes our lives easier. But of course, it also is ruinous of our character as people. And ultimately, it's ruinous of our society. And so I do think that there are ways in which we need to feel alive again to the horror of what we're doing to each other. If we continue to regard any population as disposable, that becomes a reason not to address climate, because we can just imagine those horrors being inflicted on them and not on us. But they'll come for all of us, the problems, and no one is going to be immune from the climate crisis if we don't address it. So I think we're in a very disturbing state right now where you have, again, coming from the U.S. context, you have people on the radical right, the radical Christian right, talking about empathy as a sin. And I think that's a really profoundly evil and dangerous thought. And I think it highlights the contrast with what you were saying about Pope Francis earlier, so the contrast within those religious traditions.
You could refuse to look away. We have a choice. We can actually refuse to look away.
I think part of the problem, though, is that right now we live in a society where we look at all kinds of things, but looking isn't enough.
I mean, if you really look away, you want to do something. I mean, if you really look, you want to do something. You feel you have to do something.
Well, yes and no. I mean, again, looking at the U.S. context, thinking about there was a tradition in the United States in the post-Reconstruction era, as white supremacy violently reasserted itself and tried after the Civil War to force black people to remain in a subordinate position. You know, lynchings were very common across the United States. And photographs of those lynchings were circulated, these atrocities. But those photographs weren't circulated by the opponents of lynching. Those photographs were circulated by the people who were lynching others. They were celebrating their violence. And I think we need to be careful about the idea that just seeing something is enough. Unfortunately, I mean, we live in a world now where video is ubiquitous and almost every kind of horror is two clicks away, but it's not leading people to action. And I think we want to believe that if people see the reality of what's happening, they'll do something about it. Unfortunately, I don't think that's the case.
But they're seeing it in a different way.
That's right. No, I think that in that sense, seeing is something that's very ethically laden. It's not just enough to see rightly in that sense. Doesn't mean just looking at something. It means looking at it in through an ethical lens. But that's not something that the images themselves carry. That's something that people need to bring to the images.
Many religions say that, not just Christianity, that what happens to other people is happening to yourself. That's what Jesus said, that if you do it to these, you do it to me. And if you don't do it to these, you're doing it. And many people, Buddhists and others, and in Islam, I think it's true too, in Judaism, that we're all affected by the bad things as well as the good things.
I think you're right that there are many, I mean, people can draw on any all kinds of ethical traditions in order to draw the conclusion that, as you said, the golden rule, right? Whatever you're doing to somebody else is something that you need to imagine being done to yourself. And some of that's just practical, right? If like we live in a world where that treating some kinds of people that way is acceptable, you know, then it's going to eventually, it will often be the case that the group you're a part of could eventually be susceptible to that kind of treatment. So even on grounds of, in that sense, enlightened self-interest or self-interest, you know, rightly understood or widely understood, there'd be reasons not to treat other people that way. But I also think you're right that there are, one of the other ways to think about this is the benefits that come from living in a kind of society that doesn't treat people that way. What would it mean to live in a world where no one needed to worry about those kinds of things? What kinds of goods could we accomplish? Right. What, you know, I think a lot about, you know, the evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould, you know, sort of famously said he was concerned about, you know, what kinds of, he was more concerned about finding out what kinds of geniuses had been lost to poverty than he was like trying to understand the evolution of brain size or anything like that. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we can do to reorient ourselves to our lives together is to think not only about the bad things that are happening, which are legion, but also about the good things we could be enjoying, right? What are the goods that we could have in a world where people weren't scared about being dependent on other people? The goods we could have if we weren't constantly mourning the loss of valuable environments and ecosystems. There's you know, our failure to, as it were, to live the slogan of never again is a tragedy. And one of the things we can do to move people to action is to show them the awfulness that we're tolerating and facilitating. But another way to move people to action is to show them how good things could be. And of course, I mean, we need to do both.
Can you talk about nature? Is nature part of the common good?
I think that's a very important question. And one of the views that I've tried to offer in thinking about the climate crisis is to keep in mind that we need to have everybody be a part of the solution. And people are going to have very different views about how to properly value nature or what it means to properly value nature. So I'd like to think about ways of addressing the climate crisis that include people who have a kind of belief in a kind of deep ecology, right, who want to respect not just other animals, but ecosystems, you know, oceans, rivers, rocks, who think of them as worthy of respect on their own terms. But I also think as we try to address the climate crisis, we shouldn't expect everyone to share that attitude, even if it is in a deep sense the right attitude. we need to, in that sense, think politically and think like, well, what's a coalition of people that can actually come together to solve this? And I think realistically, that's going to be a coalition of people that includes some who don't have that understanding of nature. I think what we do need to stop is we do need people to let go of the idea that nature is simply something to exploit, right? That it can be, it's a kind of, you know, infinitely giving source of, you know, free gifts for capitalists to take advantage of. That kind of attitude isn't compatible with solving the climate crisis. But I do think a range of attitudes towards nature are compatible with solving the climate crisis. And so we need to, I think the priority when it comes to thinking about nature is moving away from the idea that nature is just something that we can endlessly extract value from without ever giving anything back. In that sense, I think we absolutely need to have a certain kind of attitude of reciprocity with natural systems and really understand humans as part of them rather than as something separate from them.
Should the common good be part of a new hegemony of the way we look at the world? The common good, not of just the nature, but of humanity, of justice, of equality. A common good movement is willing to make sacrifices for humanity and for the future.
I think absolutely people need to be oriented towards some common good, and they need to be able to see what's good for them as being a part of what's good for a larger group, what's good for all of us. I do think that, as I said about nature, we also need to recognize that people disagreeing about the common good isn't going to go away. But what does need, in that sense, to go away is the attitude of, you know, I've got mine, and so I don't need to worry about everybody else. That's just a profoundly unrealistic attitude. Whatever else we can say about it ethically, the fact of the matter is something like climate shows that we are deeply dependent on the actions of other people. And we need to recognize, we need to understand our own self-interest as being connected to that.
Should economic equity and climate change justice be joined at the hip? That you need to have both, or you can't have the other.
I think that's right, and I think that's right for a couple reasons. One is what I said before, which is just that a world in which billionaires have outsized political influence is not a world that's ever going to address climate change. And so in that sense, instrumentally, we simply need to address economic inequality if we're ever going to take on climate change. But I think you're also right that there are other ways of thinking about that connection. I think that a world where some people are able to get that much richer than others is also very likely to be a world that sees nature as a kind of infinitely exploitable resource, right? One of the connections between capitalism and the climate crisis is the way that capitalism encourages us to see both other people and nature as resources to exploit, to extract value from them. And we need to move away from those attitudes, right? To not see nature as infinitely exploitable. And part of that means living in a world in which people aren't infinitely exploitable, or rather seen as infinitely exploitable. So I think there are a number of ways we could connect those dots and see economic equality as being an important part of solving climate. Another one, of course, is also just that extravagant lifestyles where some people have vastly more than others are going to mean that some people are using way more resources than is really compatible with a sustainable attitude. And also, if people with less see others with more not making sacrifices, then they're not going to be willing to make sacrifices either. So again, practically speaking, if we want to live in a world where people can be in solidarity with each other, and be willing to make sacrifices for each other in order to address this global problem that is threatening all of humanity, then we just need to live in a world that is more equal, because in the world as we live in, we are clearly not in a place where people are making sacrifices for each other. We live in a world where people are willing to make sacrifices, but it's often the case now that they're willing to make sacrifices in order to maintain their dominance over other people rather than make sacrifices for the common good.
I'm saying something I don't really like saying over the air, but I was born in 1942. And in my lifetime, people made huge sacrifices for the common good. When I was young, young people sacrificed their freedom and sometimes their life for the right to vote. And before that, during World War II, Russians and English people made huge sacrifices for the common good against fascism. And I remember reading that the working class in England ate better under rationing than they had before the war, before rationing. Could you talk about the proposition that if people are going to make sacrifices in the future, they should feel like they count and the government is governing for the common good and that they are making sacrifices for the common good? Could you talk about this?
Well, first, I want to recognize that, of course, many people are already making sacrifices for climate change. A number of people are engaged in civil disobedience and direct action and are going to jail for 4 or 5 years or longer because they're trying to draw attention to the climate crisis. So we want to recognize that there are people who are already trying to sabotage pipelines, who are engaging in civil disobedience and blocking traffic to try to get people to care. And so we know people are capable of making sacrifices, but as your examples suggest, it's not widespread enough. Now, I think there's two things that are really important about the World War II example that you mentioned, one of which I think is not good for comparing to the climate crisis and one of which is good. So let me start with the one that isn't good. Because you're not the only person who's sort of suggested we need to think about, some people will even talk about like a war on climate change, right, being the right kind of attitude. Because you do see in times of war, people willing to make sacrifices, people willing to give up stuff for the common good, for the common fight. The problem is that part of why they're willing to do that is they also know that it's time limited, right? They have a definite objective. And one of the things that's different about transitioning our global economy to a green economy is that it's not one and done, right? This is going to be a permanent shift in the way we live together. And so to that exchange, something like a war model is still focused on this as a crisis we can get beyond and not a need to really deeply transform our way of living together. So I think that's one way in which the comparison to war can be misleading. But the way in which I think it's really helpful is your suggestion, and I don't know if this is historically accurate or not, but if it's true that in fact the English working class ate better under rationing.
It's true.
Yeah. Then that is a helpful model because I think it goes back to what I said before, that we need to show people that this other way of living we need to transition to will be better for them in really important ways. And so I do think in that sense, right, we need to show people that they can do that.
I had a friend that suggested that people in America want a big truck more than anything. And it seems to me that we actually have to create a world and a society where there are more important things than a big truck, and that we can actually live better without having more and more. That you need enough for a life, but you don't need more and more. And if somehow it's possible to create communities that are happier and better without more and more, is that what we partly need to do?
I think it goes back to the program called Chaos or Community, of course, an echo of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community. And in the speeches he gave near the end of his life during that time, I think he had already hit on this point that he identified the United States and the Western world as what he called a thing-oriented society, one that cared more about stuff than it cared about people. And he saw that as being connected to the willingness to defend segregation. And he saw it in the United States' war on Vietnam. And he connected those dots at the end of his life. And I think 60 years ago, he was right then and he's right now. We do need to transition away from being that kind of a thing-oriented society.
Well, thank you very much for coming on, Benjamin, and thank you for the work you're doing. And I hope that things go well for you when you go back to the United States and you're able to carry on with your work. And a lot of people listen to the questions you're asking.
Thanks. It's been great to be here.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.